This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
When you say something like, we can become energy independent and we just need to do it through digging up coal and fracking and creating a, you know, Keystone pipeline, it's like a child saying, I can do this, I'm powerful enough, I don't need any help from anybody else, and I don't need to do anything that's inconvenient. I can handle this whole thing.
Author Steve Almond is an astute observer of American topics as disparate as candy, rock and roll, and politics. This week on Sea Change Radio, in the second half of our two-part discussion, Almond delves into the environmental movement and the moral quandary of a society that so desperately wants to have its cake and eat it too. Almond believes that behind the politics of war and deception lies a lack of empathy and willful ignorance, and that in order to have a serious discussion that advances issues as vital as the global climate crisis, we must be willing to address our imperial luxuries and abuses and honestly consider the deprivation suffered in less fortunate precincts. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author Steve Almond. Steve, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks.
We were talking about the right wing's science denial, and I can't help but link that magical thinking in some ways to what we cover here on Sea Change Radio on a weekly basis. We've profiled an IBM engineering team that's coming up with biodegradable plastics made from plant materials. We just had a guy on this week who he and his team from Caltech have created a new toilet, which not something you would necessarily consider revolutionary, but the modern toilet has been around since the 16th century, and there's over 2.5 billion people who suffer from not getting adequate clean water. Having a good toilet is a great way to go about these kind of things. So the denying of reality and science leads to people also in kind of denying that there are important innovations to be made. And somebody who wants to deny science and that climate change is real may also be totally on board with biodegradable plastics and toilet innovations. But in the same breath, they want to defund education, defund the EPA, defund grants for these type of innovations. Like this toilet was through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's grant and prize. I guess the question is, what's your greatest hope for reality-based thinking, Steve?
Well, I mean, this is something that if there is hope, it's like, okay, well, kids and teenagers need to recognize certain precepts. Like they've grown up in an era, for 30 years ago, 40 years ago, people had a vague sense, return to the land, so on and so forth. Their cities are full of smog. But we didn't really have the data to say, actually, that's going to kill us. That's going to kill the planet. That's killing our habitat. That's killing our wildlife. That's happening. That's killing our clean water and our sources of food that aren't diseased and poisoned. So now that's become, at least that scientific data exists. There is a counter industry, and I'll say industry because that's what it is, that is fully devoted because they have money at stake, billions of dollars at stake, to the short-sighted thinking that their profits are, it's important enough to their profits that they're going to try to obscure this science. But that science exists, and responsible leaders and politicians and clergy and all the rest of the people who are going to behave like adults have a responsibility to try to make sure that the dominant narrative is we're really going to die as a species. We will annihilate ourselves as a species unless we straighten up and fly right and take care of the planet, period. And hopefully, I mean, the hope that I have is that kids who are raised with that kind of consciousness just make it a priority, and they shift the terms of reality rather than saying, well, let's increase the fuel efficiency by 5 miles per gallon and hope that Detroit doesn't go under. They just say, actually, here's the deal. Let's put a gasoline tax of $2 on every gallon of gas to make it so that people are forced to find different solutions, economically forced to find different solutions. And anybody who wants a luxury car that is less than 50 miles per gallon, if you want to be a big man and drive around in your big tank, then you're going to pay a huge luxury tax. That should be treated like the kind of obscene luxury that it truly is. And I further hope that people who are in positions of leadership shift the terms of the debate. So we're not talking about, well, gee, how can we create a more efficient plastic bag, to say, how do we get rid of the need for that in the first place by creating a local economy and creating, your own land and communal gardens as a place where we get our food in the way that people have been doing it for thousands of years, directly from the source, rather than having to run it through a corporation. I mean, it is difficult to say this to people without them going, oh, you're such a hippie. But it's like, you know what, dude? Like, people have been quote-unquote hippies in the sense that they farm their land for about, 99/100 of human history. The cult of the corporation and the supermarket and all this crap we've gotten used to and the superhighway, that stuff is in its infancy. And even as a little tiny infant, it is managing to kill the planet. We have to completely shift the terms of the debate and the discussion. And people like Obama are responsible for that. I'm glad that he saved quote unquote Detroit. But if he really wants to save Detroit, if he really wants to do that, he needs to require that the fuel efficiency of those vehicles goes up to 100 miles per gallon, and that half of their fleet is something that runs on sustainable fuels that can be created from sustainable energy. You don't think that's going to stimulate the growth of people who are trying to convert algae into, you know, clean diesel or wind power or electric? I mean, there are ways to do this, and you incentivize it in capitalism and late model capitalism by making it worth money. And you have to de-incentivize other kinds of wasteful behavior that isn't actually necessary behavior. It's just convenient behavior. And I think that's the role of government and activists on the left to do that. People who see the problems have to start thinking in more radical ways about how you change the discussion from, oh my God, those climate deniers, like, screw that. Don't even listen to them. They're not a part of the discussion. They're part of a crazy corporate cult. The discussion amongst adults should be, all right, listen, we got environmental ruin coming down the pike in 10 different rubrics. How do we solve those problems? You put the best minds to work on that. You know, the healthcare system is really broken. Every time I read a piece by Atul Gawande, I say, boy, that guy really recognizes the ways in which our healthcare system is broken. Why don't we get him and a bunch of other like-minded, intelligent adults thinking about how the system needs to be refined and give them actual power to do that? That's how the Enlightenment was created. A bunch of smart people who were tired of there being wide-scale abuses of people's inalienable rights said, actually, there's a better way to go about the project of human life. And here are the principles that are set out. That enlightenment happened 400 years ago, or I should say it happened, 300 and some odd years ago. We're still having to sort of battle against a mindset, whether it's environmentalism or other sorts of dangers, that feel to me incredibly childish and primitive. I'm like, I don't want to discuss with you because you're invested in your own infantile omnipotence whether climate change exists or not. It does, and here's what smart adult people say we have to do about it. And here's what I want to hear politicians talking about, not, this site says this. There's no sides. There's science, and there's people who are engaged in a kind of cultism. I'm not interested in them being a part of the discussion. They can go ahead and secede from the United States of rationality.
I don't know if you ever force yourself to sit through the Sunday morning talking heads shows, but it's always these very serious people who have a view that both sides are to blame for X, Y, and Z. And just, it makes my head explode in a lot of ways. But the converse of the magical theory argument is that the people who are the hippies, the people who think there are answers in innovation, that they're just as magical. Both sides do it. They think that that we can have alternative energy save us from when we obviously have enough oil and coal for the next 100 and some odd years, that it's a pie in the sky dream to think that we could have biofuels running airplanes, which they can right now, but the costs are prohibitive because economies of scale haven't kicked in. So both sides do it, and we should just all go back to our little sides and not try to think too much about it. We're all guilty, but I think there's a lot more to it than that.
This is the big con of both parties, essentially. The right says a bunch of crazy gibberish that's not based in fact, but based in their emotions and their kind of childish needs and their primal fears and rage and grievance. They spout a bunch of propaganda, which the left then responds to as if it's something other than crazy childish propaganda, rather than saying, actually, here's what scientists say, and here's what we propose to do. The reason I rewrote, you know, Obama's speech is because we have shifted so far towards magical thinking that the opinions of a bunch of people who know nothing about the climate of this planet are being privileged and responded to as if they even play a role in that discussion. They don't.
Be standing in a clawfoot bath by the Baltic Sea, snapping a line on the edge of the world, listening to the Charles Mingus bird. Well, I know there's no beauty in a straight line, in the thin hem between worlds and out on time. But one of these mornings I'm gonna rise and shine. Be on time, be on time, be on time. Charles Mingus bird likes to whistle while it works. Whistle ragtime tunes from days gone by.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author Steve Almond. I remember you wrote a piece called, I'm forgetting it now, but explaining taxes to a five-year-old. There were some pictures on your blog there of people rallying, tea partiers or whatever. One said, you know, government, keep your hands off my Medicare. And there's some more hateful ones like Obama's plan, white slavery. Like these are, I don't think this would ever come from the other side. This is simply a side that is, their ignorance is being fed.
I'm not interested in blaming people who are never going to recognize. There are people who say the result that I want to reach is that America is great and I'm okay, and if I'm not okay, it's some other person's fault. That's the conclusion they need to reach because that's the psychological and emotional reality that lives inside them.
So for me being inflamed by this, I'm kind of playing into that same narrative, you think?
Well, in a sense, my point is that's its own little echo chamber of grievance and rage and fear. What people who see and recognize the dangers of what's happening to the planet and to our habitat, what they need to be doing is not engaging in a fake argument about that so that George Will or some other paid demagogue can say, oh, well, we just have an honest difference of opinion. No, there's nothing honest about it. Here's what we know is happening. Here are the practical solutions that we have to implement. Obama didn't realize. He thought, because he's basically a practical guy, he's a pragmatist, he's a technocrat, he thought, well, I'm just going to find practical solutions to the problems, and we're as practical as are politically viable. He had no idea that there is an entire part of our political system that really, not just on the right, but on the left as well, that is all about preserving the status quo and not actually making moral progress because it's difficult and inconvenient to do that. And until you really incentivize in a major way economically, that's how it works in capitalism, until you really create huge economic incentives for people to change their behavior, it's not going to change. And that's not a left problem or a right problem. That's a human problem.
So how do we eliminate anecdotal exceptionalism from that quotient? How do we kind of get out of that box that our world is the most important? It leads to this theory of what it is to be an American in the last few decades, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't mind if people have personal pathologies. I have them. I'm a hypocrite. I'm a racist. I'm petty. I'm, you know, vindictive. I'm all these things. I recognize it. I'm working on it. I'm trying to manage it. I don't want our political system to run based on people's pathologies. And that's part of what the Weak and Greed is about. That's part of what the kind of the crisis that I, as I see it, is that people's psychological and emotional pathologies are determining policy. Policy is sort of the larger moral decisions that we make as a collective. And when you have something that is manifest and apparent to people whose job it is to study it, and there are even people coming up with really good solutions to those common problems, what you do is you talk with those people and you make proposals, and at the expense of your own political capital, you put those forward to try to change the discussion and create examples of cities that are better off because they instituted public transportation, or an economy that's better off because it invests in sustainable energy, or a local economy that's better off because people are healthier, because they eat healthier food, because they grow more of it locally and it's less processed. And that's not something that happens overnight, but those are the kinds of, that's the world of ideas that I want being discussed, not this crap that lives on cable television. That's fake. That's phony. That the corporations want that to be this sort of three-card Monte game that's going on. So we can't have a clear, lucid discussion about the clearly attainable things that we could do to solve a lot of these problems that impact everyone, whether they want to be in their own personal pathological loop or not. The people who say, I should be able to drive an SUV because I'm an American and, you know, screw you if you want to take my guns or anything else. They have kids too, and they have grandkids too. And those kids and grandkids are just as much human beings as us good liberals and our wonderful overdetermined little children and offspring and, you know, Waldorf schooled kids. All those kids are you know, going to be Americans, and they're going to have to live on the same planet, and they're going to have to figure out a way to get through it. So our job is to have as adult a discussion as we can about the stuff that we know we're in trouble around and how to solve that stuff, and to ignore the rest of it as noise, because that's all it is. The corporations are there trying to pump as much propaganda into the political bloodstream as possible. That's why, you know, a rational country that really had its own self-interest in mind would say, hey, we're trying to elect people, not sponsors. Why is there any money in politics? Why isn't it just volunteers? Why isn't the power of somebody's ideas the sole determinant of whether they're going to get elected or not? And if that, you know, that plays out in small ways, we can see that Romney at the moment and Ryan, their ideas are so empty and disingenuous that they're not winning that debate. We've been down the road of giving all the money to rich people, and it always is a disaster, or it's been a disaster recently enough that people remember that and they're turning against it. But the larger problem is, why don't we have a leader on the left, the right, center, whatever, who is looking at the human problem and saying, here are the clear things that we can solve. Here are the ways that we can solve them. How does government incentivize that in the only way that Americans understand, which is making it economically attractive?
I like the sun when it shines.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author Steve Almond. Before Mitt Romney picked Paul Ryan as his running mate, you wrote, "Romney, who is like many liars, extremely handsome, may announce his vice presidential pick as soon as this week in an effort to distract the media from his refusal to release additional tax returns and his habitual and possibly illegal deceptions regarding his departure from Bain. It is not yet clear whether Romney will require his running mate to lie as much as he does. Now that you know who Romney's vice presidential pick is, do you have your answer?
When I look at kind of what's happening politically with the election, I have two reactions. One, well, I'm glad that people are finally saying, actually, that's a lie, that's not true, and that's not okay. But it feels to me like an incredible tragedy that anybody would look to such magical thinking. And, you know, Mitt Romney's proposals, it's not that it's not about personal animus towards him or the Republican Party. I don't care. I feel like Obama in that way, or who Obama says he is. Whoever's got a good solution, great, let's institute it. If Romney had a great set of plans that made sense in the real rational world fiscally, I would genuinely hope anyway that I would say, gee, that sounds like a better way to do things than what Obama's proposing.
Even though he's not on the team you root for, because this is not sports.
Right, exactly. And it's not a tribal thing. It's like, okay, well, whoever seems to be in my, you know, the most compassionate, realistic, generous, and forward-thinking in terms of how we're going to solve the crises of state that we all share, that person gets my vote. The problem is that Romney and Ryan are in a situation where they can only obfuscate, elide, and lie about what their plans are, because if they just tell people we're going to sop the rich even more and we're going to sock it to the middle class and we're going to run up the debt even though we say we want to eliminate it, and then we're going to just sort of depend on magical thinking that nobody will look at the numbers too closely, it doesn't work. People looked at the numbers. It's a sham. They have to lie. That's all they can do, is try to gin up resentment and grievance and rage and all the rest of it. In other words, the right is the capital of that kind of pathological thinking, but the left condones it and in some way feeds into it, rather than saying, you know what, we don't want to talk about, you know, we don't want to engage in a dialogue that's unworthy of our democracy. Let's talk about the problems we face and the solutions that we're going to come up with. And I'm not going to talk about the rest of it. And anytime you try to raise an attack that is a distraction, I'm going to frame it by saying, look, it's like Scott Brown right now is attacking Elizabeth Warren here in Massachusetts. And the whole reason he's doing it is because he doesn't want to talk about his record. And the reason he doesn't want to talk about his record is he keeps voting in the interests of millionaires and Wall Street guys and oil companies. And if that became clear enough that when he actually casts a vote, it's in favor of big moneyed interests, people would start to realize that just because you wear a barn coat and drive around in a truck and are an amiable guy, that doesn't mean you really have their interests at heart. You can't just play a populist on TV. What matters when you're an elected official is how you vote. That's how you tell people what your values are and what your moral code is. And he attacks her as much as he can. That's his whole strategy at this point. Just like it's Romney and Ryan's strategy, just like last time around, McCain and Palin could only launch these kind of feeble attacks because that's all they've got. There's no solutions in the Republican quiver. There are no genuine, authentic solutions. There are corporate priorities that are bought and paid for by corporations that have an interest in them. That's why all the money on that side comes from, all the big money comes from corporations. The support comes from people who would rather feel angry and aggrieved and envious and racially resentful than solve problems. And I don't think they can have a discussion, but I don't think the left, I don't think mature citizens should be a part of that conversation. They should ignore it to the extent they can. And the only thing they should say about it is, unless you have solutions, shut up. Believe me, I spend my life crazy about the right and getting so furious about this stuff. And I'm like, you know what? In the end, they win. If Elizabeth Warren, you know, wants to argue with Scott Brown about a bunch of dog whistle racial attacks, she's going to lose. The thing she needs to say is, look, you have a record. You can bully me all you want. You can't run away from your record. And Obama, I think, hopefully, is going to have the good sense to say to Romney, look, pal, you can attack me all you want and you can spout platitudes all you want. Your solutions suck. They're unfair. They're greedy. Everybody knows that. And it's because you don't really care about the entire country. You care about your rich buddies.
You wrote a fascinating piece on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Which happened about a year ago, called The Decade of Magical Thinking. And I wanted to read a quote to you from it, and then we can loop it back to how this relates to the climate crisis. You write, Freud and others were fascinated by the concept of infantile omnipotence. This is what a child feels early in his life and what he must eventually surrender when he realizes he does not and cannot control the world. There are some people, though, who can never quite accept this truth. They don't have a strong enough sense of self to sustain the psychic injury, and thus they resort to magical thinking, delusions of grandeur, angry projections, wild superstitions. They become, in this sense, more closely aligned with primitive cultures. Now, let's talk about that magical thinking.
Here's what a kid does. When a kid doesn't like the reality of what's happening, they deny it or they just close their eyes. That's what they do. Their line between fantasy and reality is blurred. The thing that is crazy-making about the discussion around climate change is we have a whole bunch of adults in charge of the whole thing. They're called scientists. They spend their life trying to figure out, they have devoted their lives trying to figure out what the climate patterns of this country are and this planet are and how they are affected in what direction. They don't have any stake in it. They're just trying to figure out, like every scientist, what's the empirical truth of what's happening around us. And arrayed against them, you don't have any counter-scientists who say, oh, this is just nonsense, greenhouse gases don't exist, all this, the car isn't really there in the road, it's not really speeding by. You have people who are closing their eyes and saying, we're not sure if that really exists, and you know, the planet changes. Like, I put my trust not in ad men or demagogues or corporations who have a clear financial stake in ginning up, you know, fake science. I just put it in the adults in the room who are the scientists. And until the country is made sufficiently aware of that and it is not a subject that's argued about on cable television, you don't have a clear message to people to make the reality of that apparent. And unfortunately, there is an entire, I think actually both parties play a role in this. When you say something like, we can become energy independent and we just need to do it through digging up coal and fracking and creating a, you know, Keystone pipeline, it's like a child saying, I can do this, I'm powerful enough, I don't need any help from anybody else, and I don't need to do anything that's inconvenient. I can handle this whole thing. And you have a young kid, at least one, I've got a couple, kids are constantly doing this. When the reality is too difficult to face and too inconvenient and too morally discomforting, they just close their eyes or they start to think magically. And if it's a little kid, you manage it as best you can as a parent, trying to avoid your kid getting seriously hurt on the playground or in a street or something. When it's the entire planet and it's your species, I think you have to be more insistent about saying, you know what? Magical thinking is going to kill us. This is childish thinking. The denial of what a bunch of scientists have confirmed, the denial of clear facts that are established by rising, you know, rising oceans and melting glaciers and all the rest of it. Nobody made that up. We didn't just have the 10 hottest, you know, years of the last 11 years in history because scientists are making it up to get more funding for their projects. That's a child's view of the kind of crisis we're facing.
Well, the conversation feels like the way I feel when I read your books, which is, it makes me want to pull out my hair in some ways, but you're nuanced and right thinking enough, that's probably the poor choice of words, to make me feel hopeful in the end. And so I appreciate the conversation. Author Steve Almond, his latest book is a collection of stories called God Bless America. People can also read him at therumpus.net. Steve, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, it was a pleasure to be on Sea Change, and I don't believe that I've ever been accused of, nor do I think I'll ever be accused of in the future, being nuanced. So I appreciate that.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Horace Silver, Boris McCutcheon, and Bob Schneider. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.